This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone. And thank you all for being here on this rather warm morning. Yesterday afternoon, we had a one-day retreat yesterday, and it was getting pretty warm. We're having humidity, which is extremely odd for us, but there's some storm coming from the south, I guess. I think there's maybe only a couple people in this room who might be old enough to remember that in the 70s, there was a radio station called KFOG, and KFOG had a lot of rock and roll, so that when it was long before streaming, there was no Spotify. This is what you did, is you listened to the radio on KFOG. But there was an announcer whose name was Wes Nisker, and his nickname was Scoop Nisker. And his sign-off was always, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. But it was also the case that he was the one who popularized, wherever you go, there you are. But it turns out that someone in our country a long time ago said this in a different way, but the same thing. Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was one of the transcendentalists in Boston and a good friend of Thoreau, once wrote, I pack my trunk, embrace my friends, embark on the sea, and at last wake up in Naples. And there beside me is the stern fact, the sad self, unrelenting, identical, that I fled from. Emerson and Nisker are both pointing to the same thing. We carry ourselves with us wherever we go. Our habitual behaviors, whether they're positive or negative or neutral, goes with us. But somehow, we have this part of us that believes that if we have a new environment, that we go a new place, that we have a new relationship or a new job, that suddenly we're going to become a different person. That all those things that have bedeviled us in the past, our anger, our disappointment, our jealousy, whatever it is suddenly going to disappear because, voila, we're in a new thing. What is this about? Why have we all come here today? Are we thinking that maybe by the time we're done here, we're going to also be very different? That we're going to suddenly be enlightened, and then we can go home and be done? Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but it doesn't work that way. You might actually have a wonderful experience here today, and you might go home and be excited about meditation practice, and that would be the best outcome. But it doesn't last in that way. You have to keep doing the work. And the work, of course, is sitting in meditation. So, the Buddha's first noble truth was the truth of suffering or dis-ease or dissatisfaction. And as I explained to the first group this morning, the first kind of suffering has to do with you have a body. You can't get around it. Your body's going to get old if you're lucky. It's going to get sick because people get stuff. Eventually, it's going to die. And, you know, it's like Thich Nhat Hanh saying in his five recollections, you know, I'm going to get old. I'm going to get sick. I'm going to die. Everything and everyone that is important to me is going to be taken away. The only thing that I can really rely upon are my actions, the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. It's not being famous, it's not being wealthy, it's about your actions. The second kind of suffering, however, well, this is called the second arrow. First arrow may hurt the body, but the second arrow is what happens in the heart and the mind. That's caused by the three poisons: thirsting desire, aversion, and ignorance of who we really are, of what this world is really all about. The first one can't be avoided. I remember years ago, a little group of seventh grade girls coming into my library. We're having a long conversation and something gets said about the body wearing out. Now, you have to remember, they're 13. And they're like, what are you talking about? And then I realized they're 13. And I said, well, do all of your families have a car? Yes. How many of your families have a new car? A few hands went up. I said, how many of your families have a really old car? A few hands went up. And I said, well, those of you with the really old car, have you noticed your parents getting upset because they have to keep taking the car in to get it fixed? Oh, yeah, my dad gets really upset about that. I said, well, it's the same thing with the human body. Those of you like you who have brand new bodies at 13, this is not a thought in your head. But as you get older, just like your car, things wear out. Now I've got their attention. They're like, what? What do you mean? I said, well, in a car, there's elastic tubes. They break down, right? There's filters. They get clogged. All of this can be wonderfully metaphorical for the human body. And the big difference is you can take your body into the repair shop, but there's only so much they can do for you. You know, they can bring out the big guns of radiation and chemotherapy or a big operation to remove something or add something. But eventually, it all wears out and you can't get a new body. Not like you can go out and get a new car. By this time, they're all, and they all very quietly went out of the library. I don't know if they remember it, but boy, I remember it like crazy because they had been laughing and then when they left, they were not laughing. However, there's not a lot we can do about that first one. The body is going to wear out. But we have a whole lot of choice about the second kind of suffering. That's the place that change can happen. But we have to know ourselves intimately in order to know that change is possible. So, in meditation, we have this opportunity to see very deeply into our true nature, who we really are, not who our parents think we are, not who our friends want us to be, not necessarily even who you think you should be, but who you really are, along with everyone else. We begin to see, when we look closely, that our desires and aversion often arise with or without external provocation. Right now, I could remember a conversation that I had with somebody a month and a half ago that was very upsetting. If I begin to think about it, I can get upset all over again. And this is even true if I think of something that happened 10 years ago. Oh, that person was so mean, or they did this, or they did that. And the interesting thing to me is not only can I remember the situation, I can remember why I was upset, and I can actually bring up all the emotional feeling around it, even though it was 10 years ago. And we do this. We hold on to stuff. We have memories that we haven't worked through, resolved, and we keep bringing it up and replaying. That's one part. Our problems are not outside ourselves. They reside right here. I know there's a lot of crazy stuff going on out there. Crazy stuff in our government, crazy stuff in our neighborhoods. You know, all you have to do is read the headlines. You don't even have to read the news, just the headlines of the news to go, oh my goodness, another murder, another rape, you know, scientific secrets being stolen, people in important positions being accused of fraud and embezzlement. This is the wallpaper of our life to some degree. The proof that it is not out there, though. When you leave here today, something I said today might stick with one of you. Something else might stick with someone else. I might say something that some of you disagree with, or some of you agree with, or some of you vehemently disagree with. But no one in this room is going to go away with exactly the same response. Our response is ours. If it were the case that the problem was out there, everyone would have the same response. So even though there are people out there that I consider to be incredibly harmful, there are other people out there who don't think that way, who think the opposite. So I have to keep reminding myself, I'm reacting this way, I'm responding this way because of my own beliefs. And they're responding their way because of their beliefs. And maybe I disagree with their beliefs, but again, we're all responding differently. So as both Emerson and Wes Knisker noticed, a change in our environment, like going off to Naples, is not going to change how we respond. So that leaves only one option. We have to change ourselves. Frankly, I think some people think it would be a lot simpler to change what's out there than changing this one here. Because by the time you get to be in your 20s, a lot of your personality and your habitual behaviors are pretty firmly in place. Zen practice is actually hard because it's asking you to take a look at all of that and begin maybe to unpack it a little bit and think about, is this useful? Is it helpful? Is it harmful? How does it affect myself and everyone else? Because when we understand about interconnection, then we also know that whatever we're doing affects everything else. It cannot be any other way. So there's a wonderful Zen koan, very short little piece. It just says, what's the most important thing? And the answer is an appropriate response. Seems simple, not so simple. Meditation, after a long period of practice, continues to try and put us in a place of readiness. Readiness to respond to the moment in front of us. Not the moment that we responded to yesterday or the one that we're thinking about tomorrow, because even if it seems like the same situation, it's this one, not that one. You know, you learn this when you teach kids. You really understand they change day to day. What worked with them yesterday, today is they're bored or they're wanting to do something different. So teachers are the ultimate in creativity to keep kids' attention because they have to meet the moment that's happening right there with that child. So an appropriate response versus your environment. Well, so we have a lot of negative behaviors. These include low self-esteem, insecurity, confusion, lethargy, jealousy, envy. So you have to ask yourself, if you suffer from any of these, does entering a new environment change those responses, or do you just see how they are now repeated in the new environment? In the same way, there are positive behaviors. Joy, curiosity, compassion, adaptability, kindness. And if those are your normal state of mind, do they change in a different venue? Are there times when you don't feel so kind, so patient? How we respond to and cope with various difficulties is due to years of causes and conditioning that brought us to this point today. It's like a 0-1. You go 0-0-0, 1-0-0, 1-1, and all of those 0-1 decisions, yes, no, good, bad, whatever it was, brought you right here to this moment. There's a reason you're in this room. You may never be back in this room. I hope you will. But every decision you have made in your life, even the ones that were made for you by someone else, affected who you are today. And here you are. So the man who founded San Francisco Zen Center, Suzuki Roshi, once said, meditation practice will not take away your difficulties, but perhaps you will have less difficulty with your difficulties. Difficulties are part of being human. It doesn't matter how wealthy you are, how famous you are, bad things happen. Somebody just asked me recently, you know, again, the old question, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, you could turn it around. Why do good things happen to bad people? Why do things happen? They do. As my teacher once said, these things happen. The difference is when they happen, how are you going to respond? So one day, I was driving up 84. And there were two motorcyclists behind me on very big motorcycles who desperately wanted to pass me. I was going 30 miles an hour. It wasn't like I was going slow. And I know the road intimately after 50 years. But they really wanted to get ahead of me. So the first one, on a blind curve, passed me. And we were just lucky that no one was coming in the other direction. The second one is now on my tail, and I'm feeling pretty annoyed. And I know that the reason I was annoyed is fear. Because if that first motorcyclist had run into a car coming in the other direction, it wasn't just going to affect those two. It was also going to affect me. I was scared. And often when you're scared, fear arises. And when fear arises, anger arises often. This is one of the things that you figure out in meditation. You keep dropping down. Why did I have that anger response? Oh, I see, because I was afraid. Why was I afraid? Oh, I see, because I thought I was going to die. Oh, you keep going down, getting to the root cause of what's actually going on. So we continue up the hill, and the guy behind me, of course, really wants to be with his friend. But I'm mad. So every time he starts, I start pulling out the car. I won't let him pass me. We finally get to the top, close to the intersection of 84 and Skyline. And they're sitting there waiting for me. The first guy, I drive up. The second guy pulls up behind the guy in the motorcycle. I confess, I did not act like a Buddhist priest. My window came down and I started yelling. It's like, who the hell do you think you are? This is my road to get home. You have no right passing a double yellow line. And then they started yelling back at me in language I will not use here. We were all so angry. And it only occurred to me later, what an idiot I am. Who knows what they would do when they were that angry? I don't know. Take me out of my car. It was not a good response on my part. I should have just driven on. But I allowed my anger to completely take control of who I am, knowing full well it was not the right response. It was not the appropriate response. The appropriate response, by the way, for those of you who will be driving home, pull over. Let the cars or the motorcycles that are in a big hurry go by. They're going to do it anyway. And then you don't have to worry about being frustrated, impatient, upset, whatever. They're gone. What always makes me laugh, because I do this all the time now, is after they go by, if they're a car, they flash their lights as a thank you. Like, I didn't do it for you. Okay. But in that moment, those many moments leading up to that moment, I allowed my poison of anger to just completely overrule my appropriate response. So I'm not promising that sitting down every day in meditation is going to miraculously cure this for you, if this is something you suffer from. But what it does is make you aware of what you're doing. And maybe that makes you think twice the next time something happens. Of, is this helpful behavior? Is this a way to create relationship? Because that's all practice is about. It's the relationship you have with yourself, with others, with all sentient beings, with trees, grass, huts. Everything is related. Did I do something good that day? No, I did not. And those two guys were probably really angry for a very long time afterwards. And who knows, maybe they drove recklessly for that reason. I did not do the right thing. But this happens to us a lot. That we are overtaken by emotional things and we say or do things that are not kind. So, you know, in the Eightfold Path, it talks about right speech and right action. I did neither that day. So there's another famous teacher who used to teach in Hawaii. His name was Robert Aitken. And he wrote a book. And he said that practice, this thing we're doing, is about the perfection of character. I'm not talking about a cartoon character. I'm talking about the old-fashioned idea of each person having character, which includes things like integrity and kindness, honesty, and a sort of overall expression of uprightness. To be upright, to sit upright, but to act and to speak in an upright manner. A manner in which, think of the person that you admire the most in your life, that you love the most, that you want to look the best for. That person should be on your right shoulder at all times, because you will do your best for that person. But most of the time, our person is not there. They say in Zen practice, you should pretend as though your Zen master is standing right behind you at all times to keep you being upright. So he says it's the perfection of character, but you know, we can only perfect it by reflecting honestly on ourselves as we are right now. Not the way we want to be necessarily, but who am I right now, right here? What have I got to work on? I know for me, it's all about anger. I have to work on it. And a lot of people, as I said earlier, they don't know that I'm working on it because it doesn't come out, but that's because I've been working on it so hard up until the day on 84. So what we need to do is figure out what is useful in our character and what gets in our way. For me, anger gets in my way. It makes me do stupid things. But more than that, think about this. When you're suffering from a negative emotion, like you're mad at your friend for, you know, they didn't keep the date, or, you know, they came late or whatever, who's the first person who suffers? They don't know you're mad at them. All that negative energy is in you. You're the first person who both has joy, and you're the first person who has anger. And a lot of times you can be angry about something, like the person who cuts you off on the freeway. Do they even know that they did? Are they aware of it? Probably not. But you're sitting there in your car going, putting yourself in a bad mood and possibly making yourself a danger to other people around you at that moment. You are always the first recipient of every mental and emotional response. So then Suzuki Roshi also said something else, which is very amusing. There was a teacher at San Francisco Zen Center named Blanche Hartman. And when she was first starting to practice, she went in to talk to Suzuki Roshi. She was already in her mid-40s. And Suzuki Roshi said to her, you are already perfect. And she said to herself, he doesn't know me very well. But in one of his lectures, he came back to that, and he said, you are already perfect, but there's always room for improvement. Because it doesn't mean perfect in the way that we normally think of it. You were perfect and pure when you came into this world. The improvement has to do with what happened afterwards. Maybe you didn't have very good parents. Maybe you didn't have a very good educational experience. Maybe you got involved with friends who were not very useful to you. All things are possible. Causes and conditions creating consequences for you. So there's a wonderful writer out there. One of my favorite Dharma books to read to kids is called The Dalai Lama's Cat. And the whole story is told through the eyes of an injured Siamese cat who the Dalai Lama rescues. And so because he is in the Dalai Lama's private chambers, gets to hear everything and every about everyone, and is there when all the people come to talk to him. And so a lot of Dharma is passed through this wonderful cat. Anyway, the man who writes the book is a Tibetan Buddhist, but I read his stuff all the time. He's a very wise man. So here's what he says. I find it helpful to think of character like a rope. Try cutting straight through a thick rope with a pair of household scissors and you'll just blunt the blades. Likewise, trying to change ourselves all at once can feel impossible. Fortunately, a rope isn't one solid thing. It is made of strands, and each strand is woven from countless tiny fibers. Those fibers are our individual thoughts. Snip enough fibers, and the strands begin to weaken. Snip enough strands, and eventually, the rope itself comes apart. When every day is different and we are rushing from one demand to another, there is very little opportunity to notice our habitual thoughts. But when our lives are more predictable, maybe familiar situations can present themselves again and again until you begin to see those habitual responses. So I'm going to leave you today with an experiment to try. That same teacher, Blanche Hartman, once said that we all fall into one of the three poisons more often than the other. Okay, so remember, there's aversion. I want what I want when I want it, otherwise called greed. Thirsting desire. I'm sorry. So thirsting desire is wanting. It's greed. Aversion is I don't want it at any time. And it's often also referred to as hatred or anger because aversion is about pushing things away. And what is the point of hatred and anger? It's to push people away, push situations away. And then the third, ignorance or delusion of your true nature, of the interconnected of everything, emptiness. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, empty of what? Empty of a permanent, abiding nature, that you are a permanent individual that never changes. Even you know that this is not true. You get older, you get diseases, you get aches and pains, not to mention that you start either losing weight or gaining weight or dozens of things. You are not in stasis, ever. So Blanche once said in a lecture something about we all tend to fall into one of those three categories more than the other. And she said, and I'm a greed person. And I was shocked because I knew Blanche and she'd always been incredibly kind and generous to me. And at first, you know, there's this whole part of me objecting to this idea. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. Blanche knows herself better than I do. But then the corollary arises. Well, which category do I fall into? For weeks, I tried to figure this out. Gee, I don't feel like I'm a greed person, but maybe I am. And thinking about that, and well, I definitely am not a hatred person. Maybe I'm deluded. You know, the problem with delusion is how would you know, right? Because if you're in delusion, you're deluded, right? Oh, I went back and forth and back and forth. And then one day the answer came to me of how to look at this. And I'm going to ask all of you to do this at some point today, tomorrow, this week. Because it took me a while to get to it, so I'm just giving you the fast track here. I said to myself, okay. For as often as I can remember to do it during the day, I am going to categorize my thoughts. They're going to fall into these different categories. You know, maybe I'm wanting. So that's okay. That's a wanting thought. Oh, maybe I'm not wanting. That's a not wanting thought. And gee, you know, maybe I just think I'm just fine the way I am. Well, that's a deluded thought. One day is all it took. I began to see irritation arose, anger arose, frustration. Not exactly hatred. This is the problem. That word's very strong, so we don't want to go there. But all those other things, they're part of it. And as soon as I was watching my mind that carefully and actually saying, I'm frustrated. That's impatience. I'm angry about that. I'm really annoyed. It was like 75% of my thinking. We all fall into habitual thinking patterns, and we need to be aware of them. Otherwise, we just keep responding from the same old playbook. Once I saw that, though, I have to admit, I said, no, please, not that one. Anything but that one. I'd rather be a green person. But that is the one I am. And I have had to work on it. I've been working on it for probably 25, 30 years. And I still get angry at the motorcyclist going by. But I'm a lot better because I'm more aware that that's the place I go. And so I reel myself in sooner. And the only thing that's different in my life is meditation. So I have to assume that it is because of meditation practice that I was able to see this in the first place and then begin to work on those crazy thoughts arising in my brain. Because when they arise, one of the things you can always ask yourself is, really, are you sure? Is that so? How do you know? You can put those questions in no matter which category you fall into. If you're going from a place of, I would just be happy if I had X. Really? Are you sure? Or is it some idea that got put in your head or some idea of where that's going to make your life easier? Always be questioning what's arising in your mind. There's a wonderful bumper sticker from Vajrapani that says, how does it go? Don't believe everything you think. Thoughts just arise. And some of them are old patterns of thoughts. The not good enough one for many people is a powerful thought. It's just a tape loop. The I'll never understand is another one. These are just tapes in your head that you have to become aware that they're there because they're causing you harm, and eventually they're causing other people harm. So there is this human tendency to think that going someplace new or starting a new relationship or a new job is going to free us from these thinking patterns. Just like Emerson, we believe that if we go to Naples, we're going to be a new person while we're there, only to discover that the same person is still there, no matter how beautiful it is. So Buddhists take a different view. Rather than fleeing from this self, we decide to look at this self deeply. And then we allow the mind to settle. Like mud in a pond. A shallow pond, you're walking through, you're kicking up the mud. The only way you are ever going to see clearly is if you stop moving. Then the mud can settle, and now you can see your feet. So during your meditation, your zazen, the thought may arise when you finally begin to see your thinking patterns. You might think to yourself, oh no, not this thought again. Instead, replace it with, how lucky am I to be able to do this? To be the science experiment and the scientist at the same time, watching what is arising, looking at it carefully, deciding, is it useful? Is it not useful? As I said earlier to the group in the instruction, the Greeks borrowed from the Buddhists. They invaded Gandhara about 300 years after the Buddha died, but the Buddhist teachings were still alive and well. And the Greeks, who liked everything from everywhere, took what they liked and went back to Greece. And so the two most famous things that we know from Greek philosophers are, know thyself and do no harm. This is Buddhism. This is the core of our practice. And how do we get to know ourselves? Meditation practice. When everything else, there's no other distractions, nothing to keep you from thinking about what's arising. You get to know yourself really well. And then maybe you also get to see where you're causing yourself harm, which eventually causes harm outside of yourself, because we are all connected. We are very lucky to be here today. It's really a privilege to be able to take the time out of our busy lives and do this practice. So I'm very grateful to all of you for taking that time, for coming up the hill, dealing with the fast cars and the motorcycles and the bicyclists and everybody else who's out there, and coming to be here to share this Dharma together. And I do hope you all come back. Thank you. So I forget the schedule. Make it a good one. And you don't have to ask about what I've been talking about. You can ask anything you want, especially those of you who are new today. Maybe because you didn't get a chance to ask any questions in there. So maybe there's something that you'd really like to know and that I missed completely in my instructions. So. Yeah. What a good question. So the question is, how do I work with my anger? Do I channel it somehow, or turn it some other way, or put it in here? Oh, gee whiz. How do I handle my anger? Well, the first thing was to realize that was what I was suffering from. Because I grew up with the mythology. See, this is the other tape that you're all going to have, something from your childhood, that nice people don't get angry. And I was a very nice person. And all of my family were nice people. Except that, guess what? My mother's form of anger was complete silence and cut you off and not talking to you for however long it took her to get out of her snit, which for a very sensitive little girl, that was like love being taken away, right? To my father, who would come home after a very long day of work, explode over something, have his whiskey and soda and then be fine. And not realize that after he'd exploded, the rest of us were all like, took me years to understand that, first of all. Both of my parents were lovely people in many ways. And certainly they qualified as nice people. But I have to tell you, nice people do get angry. Okay, so that's the first step, is identifying whatever tapes you've got going about anger. Anger can be useful sometimes. If there is injustice being done, as a teacher, I was a mandated reporter. If I saw a child being mistreated, and it didn't matter where, I have to intervene in some way. Either I have to call someone, or I have to try, without violence, to separate the child from the danger. Does that make me angry? Oh, you bet it does. Because children are totally vulnerable. Does it help for me to get angry with the person who's doing this? No. Because that just makes them angrier, right? Because they're being caught out. So first of all, becoming aware of the fact that you may have tapes from your childhood about whether it's even okay to have anger, right? And then if it is okay to have anger, what is it okay to have anger about? Because that's a whole other category. What I realized about myself, I had, like I said, you keep going back down to the root. And one of the things I discovered about my particular anger, a lot of it has to do with impatience. Things are just not going the way I want them to, or in the time frame I want them to, but it took me a long time just to see that. So you're also, as you're exploring it, as you are exploring your science experiment, you are looking for what triggers you. What are the things that make me angry? Why do I get so angry? I see, I get frustrated and irritated. I have expectations, right? There's one. Things aren't happening fast enough, but I also have expectations of how well they should be done. And there is a tape there too that took me a long time to see. My mother used to always say, if you want a job done right, you have to do it yourself. In that case, you are going to be alone for the rest of your life. But it took me years to even see and hear that tape and to question it and to say, what? Why? Just because it's not done the way I want it done, maybe somebody else actually has a better idea. So the last example I'll give, I was in Japan at a monastery. And a big mucky muck was coming, the owner of the temple, who had his own temple on a different island. So everything had to be absolutely perfect. I was the only non-Japanese person. I was the only white person. I was the only woman out of 8 people. I had more practice years than anyone except the teacher, but it didn't matter because I was a newbie there. So my status was, you know, nothing. But on this particular day, we're supposed to clean all the windows in the temple. Coming from my American view, I'm looking for rags and a bucket and maybe even some cleaning solution, right? I gave up on the cleaning solution and finally went and got my own personal bar of soap to rub into the water. I found a rag in the bathroom that looked like it had been used. But I was like, okay, I'm trying to do my best. And, you know, I don't speak very much Japanese. So I finally arrive at the place where the other monks are already working. And I get my bucket and I get my soap and water. And I'm doing, finally, the head monk very sweetly comes up. My Japanese name is Shungen. Shungen-san, please, do this way. And he takes a piece of newspaper He folds it, folds it, folds it, folds it, folds it, folds it, until finally it's only as big as my palm. He dips it in the water, folds it back the other way, perfectly clean window. Because the ink in the newspaper is a cleaning agent. You learn something new all the time. But when I thought about it later, what I realized was this monk never said to me, wrong way, doing it wrong way. Never said that. Never made me feel wrong about what I was doing. He understood that I was trying to do my best. What he was trying to tell me was, please do it this way so that we can all do it together. Okay, fast forward, I come home from Japan, and my mother and father just happened to be coming up to this area to visit. And I'm in their hotel room and I'm telling them this story because for me, this was a huge revelation. It was a big teaching moment. And I'm telling them all about this and I can just see the ticker tape going across my mother's forehead as she's thinking about this. And I said, you know, it was just wonderful to discover that it wasn't about it being a right way or a wrong way. It was the way we were all agreeing to do it together. Finally, my mother says, well, for some things, there really is only one right way. And I mean, I looked at her and I said, well, but Mom, can you understand that maybe in another culture, there's a different right way? No, for some things, there really is only one right way. And I thought, well, so for my mother, she had a tape probably from her mother, right? Who had a tape from her mother being passed down to each one of us. This is the problem with our negative emotions. We don't often know where they came from. They were given to us with, you know, the diaper and the baby bottle. And we believed them because that's what we grew up with, but we don't have to continue to believe them. That's what this practice is about, is the possibility of change. You're not going to be able to deal with your anger by analyzing it. It can't be channeled into something else. But the more you look at it, the more you become aware of the causes and the conditions of it, those strands of the rope, they will begin to break apart. It's not perfect. I still get angry. You can talk to my husband anytime. But it's a whole lot better than it was. And mostly just because I'm aware. It's like waiting there. It's just waiting for something. And it's not about something out there. It's just waiting. And I have to keep my eye on it. Thank you for such a great question. Okay, Ino-san.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.